You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And there was just an absolutely remarkable piece in the New York Times over the last, I guess it was published yesterday, February 25th, and that had just a number of things in it that I thought were so vitally important to discuss, and some issues as well around these facts that I wanted to get the author on. He is Professor Douglas Edgerton, Professor of History at Le Moyne College in Syracuse, New York, the author of He Shall Go Out Free, The Lives of Denmark Vesey, and his latest book, The Wars of Reconstruction, The Brief Violent History of America's Most Progressive Era. The university website, lemoyne.edu, and his Twitter is at Douglas Edgerton, E-G-E-R-T-O-N. Professor, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Dave, for having me.
Thanks for joining us. It's really the headline, by the way, if people want to look it up on the New York Times, is Abolitionist or Terrorist. We'll have a link to it on our website, too, at tomhartman.com. And it starts out telling the story of Denmark Vesey, correct me if I'm mispronouncing it, a black abolitionist who, as you know, was executed in 1822 for leading a failed slave rebellion. Tell us the story of Denmark Vesey.
He's a really amazing guy. He was born on the island of St. Thomas, and when he was very young, he was purchased by a Bermuda-based slave ship captain named Joseph Vesey.
But what time was that? What year?
What's that?
What year? What?
Around 1767.
Okay.
Like most, of course, ex-slaves, no one, he doesn't know exactly when he was born. The captain sort of guessed around 1767.
Right. But it was before the American Revolution.
Yes. And then the boy was sold to Saint-Domingue, modern-day Haiti, and he was obviously a really clever kid. At this point, he's about 11 years old, and it's the worst place to be a slave on the planet, what's now Haiti, the sugar cane. He pretends to have epilepsy, and so he's damaged property. So when the captain comes back with another consignment of slaves, he has to take the child back, and of course the epilepsy promptly stops. And the captain's no fool, and so realizes this is a very smart kid. He uses him as a cabin boy. Then in 1783, the British evacuate Charleston. Vesey sets up shop there as a chandler and importer of nautical goods, and uses the boy he renames Telemach, or probably becomes Denmark, is sort of a man fried in domestic slaves, and they had lotteries in those days just like we have today. And so in 1799, he won $1,500, which is a lot of money, in the Charleston East Bay Lottery, bought his freedom, but evidently was not able to buy his wife, who belonged to a different man. And so he became free, but his family remained enslaved, and became a very industrious carpenter for 22 years in the city of Charleston. Was well known to everybody. Very big man, very proud person. Married again, and was able to buy that wife's freedom. But finally, in his mid-50s, which is a real old age in a slave society, average life expectancy for black males in Antebellum America was 33 years.
Oh.
So his followers called him the old man. And the city kept closing down the AME Church, of which he was a lay minister and a very important person. And he thought about leaving and going to Liberia. But that would mean leaving behind the enslaved children from his first marriage. And so he decided to stay orchestrated what probably was the largest slave conspiracy in North American history, and paid for that with his life.
And was thus executed in 1822. I'm sorry?
Along with 34 others.
Along with 34 others who participated in this conspiracy with him. And the conspiracy, in part, was to, wake up in the middle of the night, kill your white masters, and make it to the harbor, as it were. And now, correct me if I'm wrong on that, and now you've got a statue to him has been put up in Charleston, South Carolina, and the right-wing talk radio guys are just going nuts about this.
Yeah.
This was, you were giving a talk, you talk about in your article about how, you know, more than a decade ago you were giving a talk in Charleston. And a member of the audience said, you know, why didn't this guy just work within the system to get liberated or, you know, or stage a protest march? And this told you how ignorant Americans are about what the circumstances of slavery actually were. You want to riff on that? We've got about 3 minutes here.
In fact, 2 years before his conspiracy in 1822, South Carolina had passed a law that flatly banned private manumissions, which allowed masters, if they wished to free their slaves. And so, and again, that's how VZ, you know, bought his own freedom. So the state simply bans that. So even if you just want to free your slave or let your slave buy his or her freedom, that's now going to be illegal. Meaning, the only way now to become free, you either accept your fate or you pick up a sword. This was a well-intentioned gentleman, but he said, you know, well, why not work within the system? But you know, there was no system, and we need to understand that. VZ was a tough guy. He was a tough, hard man. You don't live to a ripe old age in two slave societies, you know, the Caribbean and South Carolina, which at the time was 61% black, without developing some pretty thick skin. The plan is to rise up on July 14 as the bells toll midnight, because church bells, of course, all over Charleston. It's Bastille Day. Slay the masters and head to the docks and get on boats and get out, get to Haiti. I've spoken a lot in Charleston over the years, and I've encountered people like the gentleman in the audience who said, well, you know, but he seems to be indifferent to the death of non-combatants. You know, this is a guy whose children are owned by the people.
Right, the non-combatants being the white slave owners, but the person is ignorant of the violence that the slave owners were perpetrating on the slaves on a daily basis.
It fell down in the late 19th century. There was a jail-like structure called a workhouse in Charleston where you could send your slaves, if they were, especially domestic slaves, say, were misbehaved, you could send them down there with about a quarter and have them beaten by the workhouse whipsmen. And because it was in kind of the heart of Charleston, they wanted to baffle the sound, so residents couldn't hear the screams. And so the walls were 6 feet thick, and they were baffled with sand to sort of deaden the noise. And so that was the world of Denmark Vesey. So to suggest that he should have been Mohandas Gandhi is something to kind of yank the context out of the American past and not really understand what he did and people like him were up against in the American South.
It's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. And why is it, do you think, in the minute we have left, that so many Americans, particularly white Americans, are completely unaware of the extent of, you know, the horrific violence that was associated with slavery?
You know, living up to an unhappy past, and it's true for the North as well. I mean, I teach in upstate New York. Most of my students are blissfully unaware that we had slavery in New York State until 1827, that there were two major slave conspiracies in Manhattan, 1712, 1741. You know, sort of looking at our kind of national mirror and understanding what our past is, that's tough to do. It's easier to kind of pat ourselves on the back and focus on the undeniably good things, you know, fighting the Nazis, and sort of facing up to the really awful moments in the American past that made us the way we are today is pretty tough for a society to do.
Yeah. It seems that 12 Years a Slave is taking us, you know, one step closer to that. But even that really didn't portray the, you know, all the horrors of this institution. Remarkable. Professor Douglas Edgerton, his book is titled The Wars of Reconstruction, The Brief Violent History of America's Most Progressive Era, and which I'd love to talk with you about another time. And before that, He Shall Go Free, The Lives of Denmark Vesey, and the new article in the New York Times, Abolitionist or Terrorist. Hang on just a second, sir.
This is the Tom Hartman
Sorry,
program.
That guy always comes in and steps on me. Professor Douglas Edgerton, thanks so much for being with us, sir.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. And welcome back. Nate Sweet is on the line with us. He is one of the producers at The Big Picture, our TV show that's on at 7 o'clock tonight right here on Free Speech TV. And hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. So James Hoffa is joining us tonight.
Yeah, he'll be coming on to talk about the ongoing TPP negotiations. He's a part, you know, as many viewers know, president of the International Brotherhood of the Teamsters. They've spoken out pretty strongly against the TPP. It's going to kill jobs in America. But we're also going to be getting into some of the issues of transparency surrounding it as well with James, as well as some of the ongoing debates surrounding the minimum wage in Congress. A bunch of Maine Democrats, like even Harry Reid, have backed off from the president's minimum wage proposal and the Harkin-Miller proposal after that CBO report about it potentially killing jobs came out last week. So definitely some interesting stuff with James.
Wimping out. And, you know, it would be interesting in the setup to this to get in my meme of this is actually the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement.
SHAFTA?
That's right, yeah. So we have NAFTA, we have CAFTA, now we have the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, also known as SHAFTA, although the administration prefers to call SHAFTA the TPP. So that's our first block. That's block A. In block B, we're going to get into what's going on at Fukushima. And there's actually a whole bunch of different radiation-based news.
Yeah, new documents actually suggest that the Navy knew that the soldiers in the USS Reagan were exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. You know, the soldiers are involved in a lawsuit right now.
Hang on a second. This was the American warship that was off the coast of Japan, off the coast of Fukushima, within a mile of Fukushima, at the time that the nuclear plant was melting down and pouring radiation into the air and into the ocean. And best guess, what they were trying to do was run a power cable from the ship to the reactor because the reactor's cooling systems had shut down because the diesel engines were below the water level when the tsunami hit. Yeah, and they never did get because the radiation was so intense and for a whole bunch of other reasons, logistical reasons, they never did get that power cable to the reactors. But the ship itself was exposed to massive amounts of radiation. Back to you.
Right. And so the Navy has denied that those soldiers were exposed to any dangerous levels of radiation, but now documents show that they were exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. There's an ongoing lawsuit about this case right now. This definitely adds some dimension to that lawsuit. As well, we'll be talking with him. Some Fukushima-connected radiation has started to appear on the Pacific coast, affecting seafood supplies, and then 13 people were exposed to radiation in the New Mexico nuclear power plant. So not everything regarding nuclear power, not all the horror stories are overseas. They're happening right here in America as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the New Mexico thing was not a nuclear power plant, but that it was the one disposal site we have in the United States that's designed to deal with actinides, the super actinides, the level above plutonium and above, the man-made transuranic elements, heavier than uranium. So you might want to check that out.
Yeah, we'll have that in there.
And in fact, that's what they were finding is they were finding super actinides or transuranic elements, the higher up on the periodic table than uranium in the filters. And then Geeky Science Daily Take, we've got a whole bunch of...
Yeah, we're going to talk about how your pets have supervision, and then the Daily Take will be discussing the FDA's new labeling policy for food nutrition to see whether or not it goes far enough.
Cool. Your cat may be able to see things you can't. Thank you very much, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you. We'll be back. We'll see you tonight, Nate. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. On Wednesday, yesterday, conservative Texas pastor Robert Jeffress went off, just absolutely went off. Right-wing Watch is reporting on this. Raw Story has a story as well. He said, no nation can survive that condones what God has condemned, that being gay marriage, same-sex marriage. He's just totally, he says, the Bible specifies that marriage is between one man and one woman, and any deviation from that is wrong. As an American, he says, I realize that no nation can survive what condones what God has condemned, and God has condemned homosexuality. And then he goes on, he was joined, by the way, appearing alongside Family Research Council President Tony Perkins and Pastor Raphael Cruz, the father of Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Jeffers likened Christian pastors who allow LGBT rights to move forward in this country to German pastors that allowed for the Holocaust. Increasingly, I'm finding people are using the word that to describe human beings rather than who. But in any case, and he said that people like himself are going to be imprisoned, you know, once gay marriage happens or same-sex marriage happens across the country because, well, just that's what's going to happen, right? New hate speech laws. Well, here's, you know, first of all, I've always wondered about these people who are obsessed with all things gay, who they themselves proudly proclaim, loudly proclaim, that they themselves are not gay or not bisexual. I mean, there's been good science done that shows that the more homophobic a man is, this is literally in this science, they wired men up, they wired their penises to a contraction, that measured whether there was a physiological response to pornography, and they showed them straight porn and gay porn. And the guys who were not particularly homophobic did not respond to the gay porn. The guys who were homophobic, who proclaimed that they hated gays, they responded, they were far more likely to respond to the gay porn than the guys who were not homophobic. So there's a growing body of evidence and a growing number of people who are just pretty much right out saying, if not suggesting, and I'll write out and say it, that in a lot of these guys, and I mean, I can't speak for Pastor Jeffress, I don't know. Tony Perkins certainly fires off my gaydar, but who knows? Rafael Cruz, who knows? That many of these guys are actually gay or bi themselves, and they're just so aggressively, constantly fighting within themselves to try to repress that, that they have externalized that internal battle onto all of everybody else. Because most straight people don't care if somebody's gay or not and think it's just fine if they get married or whatever. But beyond that, there is this little factoid that I think that needs to be knocked down. And then at the bottom of the hour, we can pick up your calls about, you know, either the horrors of slavery. Douglas Edgerton, his piece was so brilliant. I wanted to highlight it. It's really worth reading. And by the way, in the next hour, at the top of the next hour, 40 minutes from now, I'm going to be telling you they have now discovered, or was a fairly high level of certainty, what causes pretty much all cancers. This is going to be shocking. I will share that with you at the top of the next hour. And in our third hour, we're going to have a Republican candidate running against Sanxpy Chambliss for governor for senator from Georgia. The Republican, who's African-American, who is asserting that the other Republicans in the campaign are bigots. This should be interesting. But in any case, this guy is making the assertion, this Pastor Jeffress, that, and he says, quote, the Bible specifies that marriage should be between one man and one woman, and any deviation from that is wrong, right? Okay. Betty Bowers, America's best Christian, has, and you can easily find this, just type into any of the search engines, Betty Bowers, traditional marriage, has produced a beautiful little YouTube in which Betty Bowers explains the fact that if you look at the Bible for traditional marriage, you know, the very first one was Adam and Eve had two boys, one killed the other, and then apparently had sex with Eve, if not with Eve, maybe with his sister, who knows. And then she goes through all these, you know, Lot and his daughters and Sarah giving Hagar the maid and King David's son having, you know, hundreds of wives and 700 wives, 300 concubines, and you know, well, Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt, so it's a table condiment, and several places in the Bible where if you rape a woman, then she's your wife, or if you, and so on. And so this is how Betty Bowers kind of summarizes it. This is what the Bible actually says about traditional marriage.
So let's recap the Lord's idea of the perfect marriage. It is between one man and his sister and her rapist, kitchen condiment, gal who's kidnapped and raped a few more women, an adulterer, and a pack of raped whores, 700 wives, 300 concubines, and the help, and a son who has murdered his brother.
There you go. So that's Betty Bauer's, if you look through the Bible for the traditional, the definitions of marriage, that's it. So why don't these guys just, like, let go, right? This is not the Bronze Age. We are not living by the values of 300 years ago. We don't stone our children to death anymore when they talk back to their parents. We don't kill the guy next door because he worships a different god than us. In fact, we don't burn a city full of people to death who worship a different god. Well, maybe they do in Iraq, but we don't do it here. We have stepped fully into the 21st century, and frankly, it's, in my opinion, time for Pastor Jeffress and Ted Cruz's dad, Raphael, and Tony Perkins to get over. I mean, either come out or stop talking about it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, in addition to that, there's some fascinating news. What happens when Democrats wimp out? I'll share that with you after the break. Wimpy Democrats. I just want to talk about wimpy Democrats for a minute. This is such a problem. The president appointed Simpson and Bowles, who both make, like $30,000-$40,000 a crack, giving speeches around the country. They're on the boards of a bunch of corporations. These guys are multimillionaires, washed up politicians and consultants and lobbyists and God only knows what all. He appoints them to this commission. The commission says, let's just screw people on Social Security with a chain CPI. Chain the consumer price index to behavior. So if meat gets expensive, people go to chicken. If chicken gets expensive, they go to cat food. So Obama puts together the cat food commission. The cat food commission comes out and says, why don't you shoot Santa Claus? Why don't you, take a shot at Social Security? Come on, President, make my day. And Obama does. Not this year, but last year. This year he chose not to. Thank God. In large part because of pressure from Senator Bernie Sanders. But last year he did. And last year some Democrats said, I support what the president does. He's the head of my party. After all, it's like, we should just go along, right? And so here, now, two stories, just, apropos of this. The first, the Democratic caucus. The president suggested originally $9 an hour. Now they're talking about $10.10 an hour as a minimum wage. It would just take us back to where we were in 1968. The CBO looked at this and said, it's going to cause some job losses. Now, I don't personally believe that, and I don't think that, and I'm quite certain that history does not indicate that. But even if it does cause some job losses, it's going to be more than made up for by lifting millions of people out of poverty. And by the way, range of job losses was as high as 500,000 and as low as zero. I would say it's going to increase jobs. But in any case, that was enough to scare the poor Democrats because it gave Fox News and the Republicans a talking point. Oh, job-killing minimum wage increase. And so now they're trying to figure out how far they should go down on the minimum wage. Right? So Senator Mark Pryor, he says, I'm okay with $8.50 an hour. He's from Arkansas. Mary Landrieu says, the tipped wage shouldn't go up. Now, the tipped wage in Arkansas is $2.13 an hour minimum wage. And it would go up to $7 an hour under this bill the Democrats are pushing in 2019. $7 an hour. Mary Landrieu, maybe there's a middle ground. I'm considering how high the increase should be. Sherrod Brown, who just, you know, takes names and kicks butt, he says, how do you start negotiating downward when the minimum wage is worth a third less than it was in 1968? If the president said $9, Republicans would have been against it. If he said $7.75, they would have given it again. I don't think you play that game. And he's right. I mean, here you have the National Republican Congressional Campaign, the NRCC, is running an ad against Alex Sink. He's the he's a Democratic candidate. He's taking on, this is in Pinellas County. There's this, open seat, an open primary, and or an open seat, and there's three candidates. There's a Republican, there's a Libertarian, and there's this Democrat, Alex Sink. Excuse me. I should say her. Alex Sink is a woman. And so the NRCC, Alex Sink apparently had made some sort of a comment back a year ago when the president said Simpson Bowles, and Alex Sink had apparently said, yeah, okay, cool. It's fine with me. So here's the ad or the statement from the NRCC. Quote, Alex, again, keep in mind, this is what happens when Democrats say okay to half measures to try to meet Republicans. The Republicans who hate Social Security and hate Medicare, they want to privatize Medicare, end Medicare as we know it, turn it into a voucher system. They want to privatize Social Security, turn it over to the billionaires on Wall Street. The Republicans came out and said, this is Katie Prill, a spokeswoman for the NRCC, quote, Alex Sink supports a plan that raises the retirement age for Social Security recipients, raises Social Security taxes, and cuts Medicare, all while making it harder for Pinellas seniors to keep their doctors that they know and love. Excuse me. That would be Simpson Bowles. That would be President Obama's proposal in his budget last year. So the Republicans who wanted to do away with Social Security and Medicare say, go on to say, sending Alex Sink, she's the Democrat, to Washington guarantees that seniors right here in Pinellas County are in jeopardy of losing the Social Security and Medicare benefits that they have earned and deserve. So here's how it plays out. Republicans say, kill Social Security, kill Medicare. Democrats go, well, we don't want to kill it, but how about if we just make it so that Social Security benefits don't go up quite as fast by chaining the cost of living to, if people stop eating meat and start eating chicken? And the Democrats and the Republicans come back and say, aha! You want to raise those? You're against those. Do you get this? I don't get it. I don't get why Democrats ever try to reach across the aisle to Republicans and say, okay, we'll meet you halfway. Because you know the Republicans, first of all, are going to say, screw that. We're not going to meet halfway. It's our way or the highway, number one. And number two, they're then going to take that attempt to meet them halfway and say, look at this. This wimpy Democrat was willing to cut Social Security. He's willing to cut Medicare. You care about... They're not going to say, now, we want to cut Social Security. No, instead, what they'll say is, you care about Social Security and Medicare, don't you? Don't vote for that Democrat. And they get away with this stuff. Okay, Mark in Nashville, Tennessee says, I'm the wimpy one because I won't use Jesus to criticize Republicans. Do I have that right, Mark?
You do have that right, Tom, because, look, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. It's solid red down here.
Right.
These people, you can't change these people's mind with numbers and simple words. You got to hit them hard with Jesus. And then, look, I'm not a Christian. You know, you lose me when the guy becomes a ghost, but all his work before that, I really.
But Jesus was the original liberal. Is that? Are you suggesting that we should be hammering that point home? I thought it was fairly obvious.
Yeah, well, it's not obvious. Trust me, when I tell you, it is not obvious down here.
Yeah.
These people don't—they don't buy that. They think Jesus carried a sword, had a black American Express card, and you know, and was yeah.
Yeah, and drove an SUV. Yeah, and the fact of the matter is, Jesus never said a thing on gay marriage, not one word.
Nope. Abortion either.
Say what?
Not abortion either.
Or and yeah, he never said anything about abortion. He never said anything about Republicans. I mean, it's an easy
attack when Republicans say, look, we need to cut Social Security so that we can, you know, build up our defense. The easy response is that what Jesus would do?
Right, right.
You know,
yeah.
And what is a Republican going to say when you hammer him with the Savior?
With Jesus, yeah.
Savior?
No, Mark, I think if you're talking to, and if you've heard the show for, you know, any number of months, you've certainly heard me do this many times. And, in fact, I made this point yesterday in a debate with a conservative, that Republicans are fundamentally unchristian. And, you know, if you want a Christian party or a religious, I mean, these values will be found in Islam and Judaism and every other religion. But good point, Mark. Thank you. Marlene in Gary, Indiana, you want to talk about people who hate gays?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I wanted to tell you when I was, little girl, my grandmother, she had two things. She said, I know where to find the devil on Sunday morning. And, I mean, I was a child. I didn't understand. And her other thing was, everybody talking about heaven ain't going there, honey.
Yeah. So your point.
I thought about that a lot. And lately, well, 50 years ago, okay, I knew what she was talking about. You ever get in the church and they gossip about each other? They talk about each other?
Yeah.
Who's doing what where?
Yeah.
And as far as gays are concerned, who has the right to tell another person how they should live?
Right. What did Jesus say? You know, he who is without sin cast the first stone. I think it applies to she as well. Marlene,
they don't hear that.
Yeah, I know they don't. And we need to tell them more often. Marlene, thank you for speaking up, speaking out, and calling in and watching Free Speech TV in Gary, Indiana. Much appreciated. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour. How do we stop Democrats from wimping out? Got any ideas? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Ken in Lebanon, Missouri. Hey, Ken, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Tom, I love watching Free Speech TV, and I love what you do and Pat and the rest of them.
Thank you.
You're discussing this minimum wage thing, mm-hmm. and the Republicans are always harping on the deficit and all that crap. If the governors across the country, and I know a few of them are starting to do it, increase the minimum wage, how many people would be taken off of food stamps, housing assistance, fuel assistance during the winter, and save the federal government and the state government a whole lot of money?
That point is made in the CBO report, but it's been completely overlooked by Fox News, Republicans, right-wingers, and frankly, the mainstream media.
Well, I hope you've got enough listeners to your show, which I'm sure you've got plenty of them, that will take this question to the governors and say, hey, don't you know that increased wages for everybody in the state will help you not have to spend so much money on food stamps and housing assistance and Medicaid people that don't have the money to pay for anything?
Right.
Wouldn't that make some sense?
Yeah. Yeah, and I've made that point a number of times, and I it's very, very well made. Ken, thank you for the call. You're spot on. Let's see here. Ken, from Ken to Ken in Great Falls, Montana. Hey, Ken.
Yeah, Tom, good to talk to you. I want to bring up the fact of our old pals, the Koch brothers, and that ALEC Foundation that they have.
All right, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Yeah.
They're going against the net metering in states, and what net metering is probably the best innovation in the solar industry that came along, and it's the way you hook up to the grid.
Right. Net metering allows you to sell electricity to your electric company when you're producing more than you're using with your solar panels on your roof.
Yeah, and you sell it at the same rate that you pay for it.
Right.
And that's the key.
So the meter runs backwards, basically.
Exactly. It literally runs backwards. They want to change that so that you sell it at a lot less than you buy it. This is the Koch brothers and Alec. They're doing it in Kansas right now. They're getting these laws passed. They're doing it all over in all the states. And that net metering is one of the best innovations. Matter of fact, it makes it to the point where our payback on a solar system is under 10 years.
And yeah, you know why they want to do that.
25-year warranty.
The reason they want to do that is because the Koch brothers are oil billionaires, and they want to keep the nation hooked on fossil fuels.
Solar is profitable, and they want to cut that back.
That's right.
A sick thing that they're doing.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Harry Reid went on the floor of the Senate yesterday pointing to these two brothers and said that they are willing to lie, use their money to lie to the American people, and that they have no, I believe he said, no conscience. Those are the characteristics typically of a sociopath, and I think we should all be very, very concerned when billionaires who are willing to lie are using their billions, or at least some small fraction of their billions, to try to change or influence politics in America. It's not a good thing, and the net metering is a great example of it. Ken, thank you very much for the call. This is net metering is a big, you know, it sounds like one of those arcane things. But this is how they get us. I mean, they find these little, with abortion clinics, let's make it so that they have to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. Well, that's a whole separate, completely irrelevant and separate thing that makes it so much harder. Or they have to, whatever. It's like they find these little areas that they can use to shut down big areas. We'll be right back. Santa Winter in our chat room says, love your Harry Reid imitation. That wasn't a Harry Reid imitation. That was a wimpy Democrat imitation. Harry Reid has occasionally been a wimpy Democrat, but occasionally he's been my hero and my anti-hero at various times, as you well know. But, you know, thanks for listening and commenting. David in Loves Park, Illinois, you've got an update on Occupy Your Local Precinct.
Yes, I do. Hi, how are you, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
No doubt about that. Well, I wanted to just give a quick update on that group of mine, the Occupy your local precinct.
Mm-hmm.
I've had about 120 people that joined when I last called into your show, and so I'm kind of hoping for a little bit more. But I gave a proposal for instant runoff voting to my county clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I am a precinct committeeman actually gave the proposal credibility.
Right.
So she's actually looking into it, and it looks like, I don't know if it'll happen like this year, of course, but probably too quickly. But, the fact is that if I had done that as a regular citizen, I mean, who knows if she had listened to me.
Right.
But as a precinct committeeman, that's what I'm, that's why I was talking about before, what you've been talking about for years, and how the, you've kind of mentioned, I'm not sure exactly how you worded the question, but what Democrats can do to kind of fight back. Well,
yes.
I think it's grassroots. We Democrats that look at the party structure, we realize there's things going on and we don't like it. Take over the party, take it at the grassroots. And, and just go from there.
Yeah, it's what the Tea Partiers did to a large chunk of the Republican Party, and at least we're rational.
This time around, this coming primary, the Illinois primary is on March 18th. As far as I know, people that I know, there's 10 of us that are going to be elected as precinct committeemen this time around. Now, that's not much, but it's a start, and
yeah.
That's kind of where you have to start. You start slow. And then you just try and recruit, and, and that's kind of what my Facebook group was all about.
That's great.
And, and I want that to happen across the country.
Is your Facebook group Occupy Your Local Precinct?
There's more in the name to it, but that is, I'm sure if people were to put in Occupy Local Precinct, I'm pretty sure it would pop up.
Okay, great. David, good on you. Thanks for the update. Keep us up to date as time goes along, okay?
Oh, and thank you for the book. You signed it, and I got it, and I've read it, and it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And good luck to all of us Democrats taking over the House this year.
There you go. There you go. It's going to be a big lift, but we've got to do it. Robert in Mesquite, Texas, listening on Sirius.
Hey,
Robert.
How are you doing, Tom?
Fine.
This is an honor. This is a real honor. I have a really important question. Why doesn't the Tea Party, since they don't really, they want to identify themselves as Republicans and everything, why don't they just have a Tea Party? Make it a third, fourth party in Congress.
Because what happens with third and fourth parties in the United States is that they never acquire power unless one of the two major powers implodes, or one of the major two parties implodes. And that hasn't happened since roughly the era of 1838 to 1860, when the Whig Party went down in flames and the Republican Party took their place. And the Republican and Democratic parties now are so solid and so in place and so entrenched that third and fourth parties are always going to be on the outside looking in. And they tend to hurt the party that they're most closely aligned with if they play a significant role in elections. And so when the Koch brothers and the other billionaires who put together the Tea Party did so, and, I mean, you know, keep in mind this started out with the tobacco industry back 20 years ago when they first registered the name and had the Tea Party as a smoker's rights party, when they did this, they were very, it was very clever. Call it a party so that people feel like they're part of something, but insinuate it into the Republican Party, make it part of the Republican Party. And as long as, you know, you get a couple of high-profile Republicans who identify themselves as Tea Partiers, you know, Ron Paul, Rand Paul, and the like, Ted Cruz, then, you know, you've got some legitimacy within the party, and then eventually you can take over the party. I wish that the progressives would do that. There is no good, you know, there was a small attempt with the Coffee Party, but it never really went anywhere because it wasn't financed by a billionaire. It didn't have a New York and Washington, D.C. PR offices. Didn't have, $500,000 buses that could transport people to events, didn't have a big budget to make signs and to get media and all that kind of thing. So that's why I say, you know, for progressives, I think the thing to do is you could participate with the Green Party all day long. It's great. And particularly at the local level, there's some really good work being done, but you can also be in the Democratic Party, be a part of the Democratic Party, and help take back the Democratic Party.
Well, wouldn't this help out right now? They're more just kind of fighting each other right now in the midterm elections. One in question is McConnell. You know, I mean, he's fighting for his deal, but he's got a Tea Party running against him.
Yeah, the odds are that he's gonna beat that Tea Party fairly easily. And he's going to end up going against Alison Lundgren Grimes, the Democrat who's running, you know, in Kentucky. And but there are places where Tea Party candidates are going to win, and that's where, you know, if the Progressive Caucus, I guess, is a great place to start. But I think simply saying I'm a progressive Democrat is enough. We don't need to do a party within the party and have internecine warfare. It's time to take the Democratic Party to the extent that it can be done and in the places where it can be done, you know, away from the Democrats who want to compromise with the Republicans and who are the corporate Democrats and start, you know, pushing the memes of the grassroots populist progressive Democrats, because that's frankly where America is at. Those are the Democrats who actually can win elections. And I think that, you know, Sherrod Brown is a great example of that. Robert, thanks for the call. And for bringing the topic up. As I said, after the break, after the news here at the top of the hour, I'm going to share with you the latest research on the thing, the number one thing that is in all probability causing the vast majority of cancers in America of all kinds.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer. maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
So it's about 20 years ago we got these nutrition labels. Welcome back to the program, by the way. We got these nutrition labels on packages. And what I think is interesting, particularly interesting, is that there's a fair amount of evidence that there is one thing that has been causing the majority of cancers in America. Breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, you name it. One thing. And one of the things that points to that is a fascinating study that was done with Inuit people. Well, in fact, before that, Frederick Banting was the guy who in 1923 won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of insulin. And he came to the conclusion that diabetes was caused by refined sugar. He was the director of the Public Health Institute at Columbia University. Excuse me, Haven Emerson was the director of the Public Health Institute at Columbia University. And he reported, and Frederick Banting took that report, he reported that diabetes deaths in New York City had increased 15-fold, 1,500% since the Civil War. Now, this was 1923. The deaths in New York City had gone up fourfold alone between 1900 and 1920, 400% from diabetes. And this coincided almost exactly with an increase in sugar consumption. Because the 1890 was when we first saw the beginning of the sugar, the candy industry, and the soft drink industry. Okay, so the guy who won the Nobel Prize was pointing that out. John Yudkin, a leading authority on nutrition in the United States, did a series of studies back in the 1960s. Feeding sugar and starch to rodents, chickens, pigs, rabbits, and college students, he found that the sugar, not the starches, but the sugar, invariably raised blood levels of something called triglycerides. It's a fancy word for fats, which are, we know now, are a risk factor for heart disease. It also raised insulin levels, which tied the sugar back to type 2 diabetes. Another interesting observation. I'm getting, by the way, most of this from a piece that Gary Taubes wrote in the New York Times on April 13th, 2011, titled, Is Sugar Toxic? That during the Korean War, pathologists doing autopsies, he writes, on American soldiers killed in battle. And most of these American soldiers were teenagers, had plaque in their arteries, meaning they were already on their way to heart disease, whereas the Koreans that were killed in battle during the Korean War did not, regardless of their age. Koreans at that point in time, like Japanese, were not eating high-sugar diets. Americans were. There was another study in the 1970s called the Seven Country Studies, similar results. They used to think that it was fat that was leading to this buildup of heart disease. And I'm going to get to cancer in just a second. The evidence for cancer is even stronger. But what they found is that when high levels of sugar are introduced into the bloodstream by, like, eating a candy bar or eating something that's sweet, eating muffins or, pancakes for breakfast or whatever, that that hits the liver really fast. And the liver responds by producing a type of fat that stays in the liver. And you get this fatty liver. Fatty liver then causes insulin resistance. In fact, quoting from the paper, the correlation between liver fat and insulin resistance, lean or obese, is remarkably strong. Samuel, he's quoting one of the scientists, Varman Samuel, who worked at Yale School of Medicine. He says, when you deposit fat in the liver, that's when you become insulin resistant. So what causes liver to accumulate fat in humans, he raises? A very real possibility is caused by sugar. In fact, he notes, Gerald Raven at Stanford University says, if you want to cause insulin resistance in laboratory rats, feed them a diet on mostly fructose is an easy way to do it. It's very obvious, very dramatic effect, Raven says. These changes can happen in as little as a week. If animals are fed sugar or fructose in high amounts, 60 to 70% of their diets, but if you give them 20% of the calories in their diet is sugar, which is below the American average, rats will develop fatty liver, insulin resistance in about 2 months. Stop feeding them the sugar, and the fatty liver promptly goes away, and with it, the insulin resistance. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. One of the diseases, he notes, that increases with incidence of obesity, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome is cancer. In fact, the connection between obesity, diabetes, and cancer, first reported in 2004 by the World Health Organization, is not even considered controversial. There's an absolute correlation. You're more likely to get cancer if you're obese or if you're diabetic or both or if you have metabolic syndrome. Malignant cancer, the second observation he writes, is that malignant cancer, like diabetes, was a relatively rare disease in populations that didn't eat with Western diets. And in some of those populations, it appeared to be virtually non-existent. No cancer at all, of any kind. In the 1950s, malignant cancer among the Inuit, for example, was deemed sufficiently rare that physicians working in northern Canada would publish case reports in medical journals when they diagnosed a single case. In 1984, Canadian physicians published an analysis of 30 years of the Inuit. The Inuit are the folks that used to be called Eskimos, right? Way up north. And as they started to eat a Western diet, lung cancer, cervical cancer started going up, but there was still a conspicuous deficit in breast cancer rates until the 60s. And as their diet became more and more like the rest of North America, now they have breast cancer rates that are at or even above that of people in the lower 48. So what's the mechanism? Well, as Gary Taubes writes in Is Sugar Toxic, cancer researchers now consider that the problem with insulin resistance is that it leads us to secrete more insulin, and insulin is associated with a hormone called insulin-like growth factor, IGH, or IGF, which actually promotes tumor growth. Our cells come to depend on insulin to grow and multiply. And he said it also provides the signal to cells to grow and multiply. The more insulin, the better they do. And so some cancers develop mutations that actually make them I'll read it. Some cancers develop mutations that serve the purpose of increasing the influence of insulin on the cell. Thompson believes that many precancerous cells would never acquire the mutations that turn them into malignant tumors if they weren't being driven by insulin to take up more and more blood sugar and metabolize it. At Beth Israel Hospital in New York, the cancer center there, and at Harvard Law School, Lewis Cantley works in both. He says cancers like breast and colon cancer, up to 80% of human cancers, are driven by either mutations or environmental factors that enhance or mimic the effect of insulin on the incipient tumor cell. So, bottom line, I'm going to quit eating sugar. But this is the new bottom line here is these new nutrition labels that the Obama administration has proposed. They will now list added sugar. This is important stuff.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, there are a lot of other nutrients that I'd like to know about, you know, like GMOs and things, but added sugar, I'm increasingly getting freaked out about. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bruce in Buffalo, New York, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Bruce, you wanted to talk about the Democrats, the wimpy Democrats issue that I raised in the last hour.
Yeah, but I hate to change the subject, Tom. That sugar thing is so important. I think it's refined sugar, too. There's a difference.
Well, yes and no. If you eat sugar in the raw sugar, which is basically sugar with molasses, you still get this wild hit. The issue is does the sugar hit the liver fast enough that the liver metabolizes it all by itself, or does it diffuse through the body slowly enough that it doesn't hit the liver, but instead every cell in the body gets it? And that latter is what happens when you eat starches, so you don't have a problem with the fatty liver and insulin dependence and thus cancer. Whereas when you eat any kind of sugar that actually tastes sweet to you, it's going to go right straight to your liver, and it's going to produce this metabolic syndrome that then leads to cancer.
Scary stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, or at least anyway, I'm not making that as an absolute assertion. That's where increasingly where the science is pointing.
Oh, no, I totally agree with you. Now, you asked the question before, what can the Democrats do to get their backbone?
Yeah.
And I've been sort of looking around, and first of all, who has the bully pulpit? That's the criteria.
First right now it's the president. Although a lot of what he says gets ignored by the mainstream press.
Hang on a second, my friend. The second one is who has the strength and the wisdom. And as I was searching around, I came up with one person. I thought of Bernie Sanders, but he's not a Democrat. He's unfortunately, in this case, he's...
Well, he caucuses with the Democrats, so he's...
He caucuses, but anyway... I came up with one individual that has the bully pulpit, has the wisdom and the strength and the courage to issue 5 talking points each week. Tom's talking points. Every Monday, if you came up with 5 talking points...
You know, actually we should do one talking point each week.
...of listeners who can advise you and mold them and shape them during the week. And then 5 more the next Monday.
Right.
Tom's talking points would go viral on the internet, and people would be behind because the people already are there. They just don't all know it yet.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and it's something that I'm going to have a conversation with my producers about after the show is over. But I think that instead of 5 a week, that would be hundreds a year. The Republicans have done really, really well with like 1 every 6 months or 1 a year. You know, it took them 2 years to get death tax into the main vernacular. So maybe 1 a month, which would be 12 a year. And that might even be a lot. Maybe 1 every 2 months.
Yeah, all right, these are details.
Yeah.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And I do have a fairly large pulpit here and some credibility, I guess, at the moment. And we should be using it while we've got it. It's an excellent point, Bruce, and we can crowdsource what those talking points should be. We've got about 10 seconds. You got a quick suggestion for the first one?
Go for it, Al.
Do you have a quick suggestion for what the first talking point should be?
Yeah, financial reform, election reform.
Election reform. Okay, great. That's a good starting point. See, I think we can't have election reform until we say that money is not speech. I'm inclined to think the most important thing is money is not speech, the First Amendment. Okay, Thompson, this is one of the scientists that Gary Tobbs interviewed for this piece in the New York Times. Craig Thompson, who is he's the president of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. The president of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Craig Thompson, who's talking about how cells require the insulin to reproduce and that what causes that is if you eat starches, you don't have this problem because starches slowly release in the body. So the, the liver doesn't go hyperactive. And obviously, if you eat proteins, you don't have this problem. But if you eat anything that tastes sweet, sugars, you know, monosaccharides, disaccharides, fructose, glucose, sucrose, if you eat these sugars, bang, this is what he says, Thompson. I have eliminated refined sugar from my diet and eat as little as I possibly can because I ultimately believe it is something I can do to decrease my risk of cancer. This is the president of Sloan Kettering. Another scientist he quotes in here, Cantley, he says, puts it this way, quote, sugar scares me. You know, sugar really came into the American diet after the Civil War in a big way. Prior to that, it was a rare condiment. It was quite expensive. And prior to that, we didn't have much cancer. And the cancer that was out there was more among the upper classes who could afford to eat sugar. In fact, there was a time in the mid-19th century when you can look back at some of the patent medicines, and sugar was sold as a medicine, as a drug. And there were problems with sugar addiction. So, you know, sugar, yeah, it makes us fat. But worse than that, the mechanism that it uses to make us fat, and this isn't a matter of lots of fat or little fat. He's talking about metabolic syndrome skinny people can have, right? Do you get up in the middle of the night to pee two or three times? If you're not an older male with a prostate problem, it might be metabolic syndrome. This is one of the symptoms. Do you crave sugar? Do you crash after you eat it? Do you go through swings? Whether you're, you know, regardless of what your weight is. And fructose is the worst of all the sugars, by the way. Now, if you get fructose in an apple, you got no problem because if you eat the apple, there's all that fiber in there that's going to cause it to be released slowly into your bloodstream. But if you're getting high fructose corn syrup, bang, right to the liver. But it's not just high fructose corn syrup. It's basically all these things. This is, again, quoting from Gary Taub's piece, Is Sugar Toxic? In the New York Times, April 13, 2011. The fructose component of sugar and HFSC, high fructose corn syrup, is metabolized primarily by the liver, while the glucose from sugar and starches is metabolized by every cell in the body. Consuming sugar, which is a combination of fructose and glucose, means more work for your liver than if you consumed the same number of calories of starch, which converts into glucose. And if you take that sugar in liquid form, soda or fruit juices, the fructose and glucose will hit the liver more quickly than if you consume them, say, in an apple. The speed with which the liver has to do its work will also affect how it metabolizes the fructose and glucose. He notes, we are in trouble. And then he goes through this whole thing. This causes insulin resistance, fundamental problem in obesity, underlying defect in heart disease. And also, it might also be the underlying defect in many cancers. Now, the one guy who says, well, you know, yeah, it might be toxic, but you have to be careful how much you take, you know, all things in moderation. That guy is Walter Glinsman. He was the primary author of the 1986 report by the FDA, noting the association between high fructose corn syrup and sugar and obesity and type 2 diabetes and cancer. But now he's an advisor to the Corn Refiners Association. Right. Do you know how much sugar we're eating right now? The best estimate from the USDA as of 2011 is 75 pounds per person per year. This is spooky stuff. sugar consumption in these this seven country study done back in the 70s, sugar consumption was predictive of heart disease. This was heart disease. At first, they thought they were looking at fat. They were measuring body fat in people, and they were saying, hey, more fat, more heart disease. Then they discovered that it wasn't the consumption of fat that was doing it, because these different countries, people were eating different quantities of fats and different types of fats. It was the one common denominator was sugar, particularly fructose. I'm telling you, the explosion in obesity in the United States among our children correlates in with about a 4 or 5 year lag time to the introduction of high fructose corn syrup in our soft drinks. I think it's time. You know, it's like, you know, if you think there's a crash coming, you get out of the stock market, right? If you think the sugar causes cancer, and really this is, it's still considered extreme position in medicine. And yet the science is pretty irrefutable. That candy bar could literally cause you to get cancer. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll get back to that. And also, how do we deal with a wimpy Democratic Party?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In just a few minutes, right after the news here at the bottom. Digamously Ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good Senator Elizabeth Warren. During a speech at Georgetown University yesterday, the Massachusetts senator made a passionate plea for lawmakers in Washington to consider the civilian tolls of our actions abroad. She said, "The failure to make civilian casualties a full and robust part of our national conversation over the use of force is dangerous. Dangerous because of the impression that it gives the world about our country, and dangerous because of how it affects the decisions that we make as a country." Couldn't agree more. It's good to see that Senator Warren has the same clear-sighted views on foreign policy as she does on domestic policy. The bad. David Ralston. Last year, the Republican Georgia Speaker of the House authored an ethics reform law that he said would prevent lobbyists from making gifts to state lawmakers. But now it appears that Ralston doesn't really believe in his own law. Ready to think progress, he's taken advantage of a loophole in that law to help state legislators get free gifts from the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. Ralston's critics are now saying that his ethics reform bill is just a way to deflect attention from his own corruption. What a hypocrite. And the very, very ugly, Derek Hester and Daniel Zelzer. The two Midland, Texas police officers have been suspended for 3 days without pay for holding a contest to see who could steal the most signs from local homeless people. Seriously. According to the Associated Press, the contest went on for 2 weeks and only ended when Officer Hester's truck was searched for a missing item picked up on a routine traffic stop. As part of their suspension, Hester and Zolzer have been reminded by the Midland Police Department to respect individual rights and human dignity. You know, because it's so easy to forget about those things. That's very, very ugly. Mind-boggling. Well, this is interesting. Over at AmericaBlog.com, Gaius Publius blogging about why is it that Democrats might go that third way, might go down that road of supporting kind of Simpson-Bowles stuff. I haven't, frankly, I haven't read the entire piece word by word, and so I'm not going to comment on it yet. I probably will tomorrow, but one thing that occurs to me is that we mustn't ever forget the importance of self-interest. I mean, you look at, you know, the former commissioner of the FCC, head of the FCC, chairman of the FCC, Michael Powell, is now the head lobbyist for the telecom industry. The former head lobbyist for the telecom industry is now the chairman of the FCC. And before becoming chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler made, it's reported, over $19 million doing this stuff. He'll have a very, very lucrative job when he leaves. So if you're a Democrat, and you can kind of see this by looking at the life of Bernie Sanders, who's not a Democrat, he's an independent, but you know, if you're a Democrat and you take these principled positions, these principled populist positions, you're not going to get rich in office or when you leave office. John Boehner spent his whole life basically being a public servant. And he's a multimillionaire. How'd that happen? Bill Clinton spent his entire life as a public servant, making, you know, not a great deal of money, and he's now worth $100 million. How did that happen? Well, if you dance to the corporate tune, I mean, there are billionaires on the left just like there are on the right, at least with regard to social issues. If you dance to the corporate tune, then even if you lose the election, they will catch you when you fall. Whereas if you don't dance to the corporate tune, if you take the positions that Mark Pocan is taking, or that Sherrod Brown is taking, or that Jan Schakowsky is taking, or that Bernie Sanders is taking, if you don't dance to that corporate tune when you leave office, there's not going to be that feather cushion for you. Jimmy Carter is still on his own. So that might have something to do with it, too. But I think, this is not about corrupt politicians. It's about a corrupt system. And it's not about a corrupt system that was brought to you by the Democratic or Republican Party. It's about a corrupt system that was brought to you by five right-wing justices on our Supreme Court who have claimed that they have the power that kings used to have to strike down laws passed by a democratically elected Congress and signed into office by a democratically elected president when they themselves were never elected by anybody. They were appointed by a president and approved by the Senate. That's it. And they serve for life. And they have the audacity to say, and we don't even want a camera in our courtroom. We have, you know, the cancer at the core of the American system right now is our Supreme Court. And they're inventing law out of nothing. They're coming to the conclusion in the Buckley case, after Mr. Memo, Lewis Powell, joined the court, coming to the conclusion that the First Amendment, which protects free speech and the right of association, also protects money in politics. Coming to the conclusion that the 14th Amendment, early back as 1886, the Santa Clara County case, where the court actually ruled the opposite, but the headnote says the opposite of what the ruling does. But more vividly in the modern context, in the First National Bank versus Bilotti case, 2 years after Buckley v. Vallejo, finding that the 14th Amendment definitely protects corporations, gives them equal protection rights, not privileges, rights, under the Constitution, and then tying the two together in Citizens United. And that has produced a corrupt system which is devastating our country. And frankly, I think devastating the Democratic Party, has already totally corrupted the Republican Party. Josh in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for allowing me to get on with you.
Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Washington. So you wanted to talk about the Supreme Court, too?
Yeah, most definitely. I think I agree with everything you just said. And the other last week when you mentioned that we need a constitutional amendment denying them citizenship, I don't know, I jumped backflips because that was the first time I heard answers to what I think is the genesis to most of our problems in America today.
Yeah, we need to extract this cancer from the core of our society. The cancer is the Supreme Court decision, or this series of Supreme Court decisions that culminated in Citizens United, that says that corporations are people under the 14th Amendment and protected by the 14th Amendment, and money is speech protected by the First Amendment. And yep. and these half-assed measures or half-hearted measures or halfway measures that are promoted by groups like Public Citizen, et cetera, that say we're only going to we want to amend the Constitution, but only to say that for-profit corporations are not protected by the 14th Amendment because we're a nonprofit corporation and we want to continue to be protected by the 14th Amendment. I think that's a total cop out. I am so saddened by that because, you know, one of the major ways right now that corporate money is corrupting and billionaire money is corrupting politics is through the agency of not-for-profit corporations. Karl Rove runs one. American Legislative Exchange Council is one. I am perfectly willing to say no to all of them because what will happen then is, yeah, public citizen or, you know, a union may lose a little bit of power in the ability to buy television ads and speak in the public, you know, arena because they will be subject to campaign regulations the same as everybody else. But because these are membership organizations and because these are you know, I don't know if public citizen is a democracy, but certainly a union is a democracy, they can speak to their members and their members will act, which is a very different thing than a corporation. A for-profit corporation, if the CEO of the company that you works for says, hey, would you please vote for Mitt Romney? He's a friend of mine. You are probably more inclined to vote against Mitt Romney for that reason. So I think these guys are shooting themselves in the foot. They're very short-sighted by saying just for-profit corporations. And it's not just public citizen. There's a bunch of them out there who are saying, let's just go after the for-profit corporate. No, all corporations. Take the rights away from unions, too. And it'll actually give unions more power than corporations in that marketplace of ideas when we're done. Josh, thanks for the call. And that's what Move to Amend is doing. MoveToAmend.org is the only group I know of that's got offering a pure amendment that says, you know, no corporate protections, no billionaire protections. Susan, in Wanna, Washington, we have just a minute, Susan. You wanted to talk about sugar and its effect on fungus in the body?
Try to be quick. A fellow by the name of Doug Kaufman calls it FUPO, fungus until proven otherwise. The book I'm citing was written in 1973 by William Dufty, called, and that's Dufty, D-U-F-T-Y.
Called Sugar Blues. I knew Bill Dufty.
And
I used to sit in Gloria Swanson's apartment and have long conversations with him back in the 70s in New York.
So grains affect it as well as sugar. I have severe Crohn's disease. My other favorite book is the one by Earl Mandel, Secret Remedies.
Right.
But the thing you have to think about is what you were saying, the triglycerides rise. The IgG, which is the immunoglobulin growth factor. The other part is the ACTH, the cortisone that we produce within our body. But it is a fungus. In fact, there is a site by Tom Volks, like the Volkswagen, and he has proven also by the various types of funguses, more than 45...
that they're living on our sugar that we eat. Yeah. Susan, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There are so many different dimensions to this and permutations to it. Susan, you might want to Google autoimmune therapy. And another one worth Googling is helminthic therapy, H-E-L-M-I-N-T-H-I-C. But anyhow. So, Myron in Sharon, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV system. You wanted to talk about why you left the Democratic Party after 45 years?
Yes, Tom. My father was a Democrat his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was until I put 45 years in and just watched from the 60s. Downhill with the party, switching over to the same way that the Republican Party is. Tom, with your sugar and what's happening in this country, it all relates to one thing, and I've mentioned it to you before, addictions. I've been involved in addictions and work in addictions for 48 years. And when you become addicted to something, you're in trouble. People that get addicted to money, they become billionaires, maybe, or multimillionaires. People that come addicted with sugar are using 75 pounds a year. Anything you can think of that you overdo. Why do we get into addictions? Because we're doing something that is not right for us to be doing, and that addiction is a hideout for you to bring you some peace.
Well, it could be. I think we get into a lot of addictions because our bodies are wired to be hunter-gatherers on the savannah. You know, in the environment in which we evolved, if you found a comb of honey, or you found the fat in an animal, that was an essential nutrient. I mean, that was an opportunity for your body to stash a little storage, you know, stuff aside, you know, and put fat under your skin or in your liver or wherever it puts it. But you would go back to the baseline of running for miles every day and looking for food and being hungry a lot. But we have genes that wire us for those things. And the craving for sugar, you know, and the craving for alcohol, I think, are probably the same thing. Alcohol is rapidly metabolized by the liver into sugars. And the craving for fats, I think, is the same thing. And I don't see this as some sort of social or psychological failure. I see this as our genes, our genetic predispositions being exploited by for-profit corporations that have figured out. And we also need salt, right, because we sweat salt. And so these for-profit corporations have figured out the right combination of sugar, fat, and salt, these three things to which we are genetically predisposed to get addicted, to get us and keep us addicted.
That's right, and that's how they have done the other things, by promoting everything that they want.
Well, they want to make a buck, and so they're selling you Twinkies. You know, they want to make a buck, so they're selling you donuts. You know, it's fried, it's sugar, it's got salt in it. They want to make a buck.
And the only one that can control that is each of us as an individual.
Well, and it takes a level of self-control that's way beyond the average person. I know it's beyond me. I mean, I've been eating sugar every night for years. I think, you know, it's something historically that I, throughout my life, I've used to get to sleep because I crash after I eat sugar. And after reading this article, I'm going, whoa, wait a minute, I gotta, you know, I'm gonna, and from what I've read, you know, Bill Duffy was telling me this stuff 25 years ago, and I didn't take him seriously. And he was saying, you know, when you quit the sugar, you actually go through a withdrawal that lasts a few weeks to a few months, and then your body shifts into a different gear. I'm gonna try to see if I can get there. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on with all the news of the day. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. Bob Ney is on the line with us, the author of Sideswipe, former U.S. member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Bob, welcome back.
Thank you, and former sugar addict.
Former sugar addict, there you go. Okay, we have been talking about that, yeah. Sugar addiction, alcohol addiction, I think that they're tied together.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I believe that.
Yeah, so.
Well, the addiction.
By the way, how did you overcome your, if you said a former sugar addict, how did you overcome your sugar addiction?
Well, you know, I haven't had a drink since 2006, but after I stopped drinking, I craved sugar like a madman. And I would have cookies and things like that, and they encourage you, actually, after you stop drinking, to have sweets. But at one point in time, Tom, I would wake up and feel like I had been drinking
right. All
night. And, I did a little bit of research on it and talked to some people that are pretty involved with, you know, health, and they told me about the new modified wheat, which is an addictive,
right.
And also of the sugar. And, I mean, I can't say that I've eliminated it, but, you know, I really watch about the use of sugar. I don't put sugar into anything. I've learned to eat my cereal without sugar, et cetera. I use, you know, yogurt, and I'll put a protein drink mixture in there, which is a little bit sweet but no sugar in it. Mm. Things like that. A little bit of substitute.
Yeah, and you're a skinny guy now, and you used to be a very large guy.
68 pounds.
Wow. Wow.
Yes, I did.
Okay, back to the news.
Well, yeah,
good on you, by the way.
Probably better than the news, what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Just a couple of things. Of course, the Arizona huge impact, although there are about five states, including my home state of Ohio, which are considering not exactly the same as the anti-gay bill, but similar types of pieces of legislation. But I think that the chill factor of Arizona will, you know, make people focus, you know, quite heavily. And as they say, well, the governor pondered and she met with both sides, but I think that the three words did that bill in, the National Football League, amongst one, you know, Apple, Hispanic Bar Association, the Intel, and the Marriott, but especially the NFL said, look, we'll go elsewhere. So the governor vetoed that bill. But I still think that the remaining states that have similar bills, there will be a huge chill effect.
Do you think it's possible there'll also be a rebound effect, that some states they'll just, you know, double down on their effort to get it through fast?
No, I think what they'll do is they'll have to really, really water it down if they have something in particular that is saying to businesses you can't be unfairly sued or something of that nature.
Right.
How you craft.
Yeah, and this is all in response to two lawsuits, one out of Oregon and one out of someplace else that, you know, had to do with a photographer and a wedding cake, and that Fox News had just blown way out of proportion.
Right. And the judicial system can really take care of that if they wanted to. Honestly.
Sure. There's this thing called frivolous lawsuits.
And they can slap a lawyer's hand for even introducing one, but, you know, that hasn't happened, and that's really kind of the way to solve it.
Interesting.
I did want to mention, since you were talking about sugar, but the food labeling bill, Michelle Obama, the First Lady, took a very out front position today and hosted an event with the White House about food labeling, making it clear. It doesn't go as far as it probably needs to go, but it's a definite step in the right direction.
Well, and this is the first time that it's going to list, instead of listing sugars, it's going to list added sugars. Do I have that right?
Added sugar.
And that's a big deal. Because there are naturally occurring sugars in a lot of food, but added sugars, you know, raisins and things, but added sugars, that's the bingo. That's the cancer danger, the obesity danger, the type 2 diabetes danger.
That's right, and you will see different items in stores that will say no sugar added, but they don't really say, you know, when they have already added sugar. And this is usually a big controversy. Years ago in D.C. it was, because you will get the vested interests in Washington that don't want to spend the, you know, millipennies or whatever you want to call it to make these changes. They simply don't want to do it.
Yeah, interesting. Well, this is... You know, I'm saying while they're doing this, I mean, the industry is going to spend $2 billion changing their labels, which was their argument against GMOs in California. If they're going to have to change their labels, here's a perfect opportunity to add to the list of things that they got to put on the labels, whether or not it has GMO content and country of origin labeling.
Well, that's another one. The Beef Association, the Cattle Association's always wanted that to be done. The stores didn't want it to be done. And, of course, the foreign interests, companies that have interest in Australian beef or Argentina beef, et cetera, they don't want it.
Right. And thanks to Citizens United, they can actually lobby our members of Congress.
Oh, they can spend a lot of money,
and
they do with these types of issues. You know, the one thing I wanted to mention, this one still is just baffling to me, Tom, but the Veterans Bill has failed in the Senate. Senator Sanders carried that bill. And the arguments are amazing. And Mitch McConnell was arguing about the AIPAC issue, the American Israeli political action group. And he was arguing about putting Iran sanctions into the bill because they just want to, you know, poke the president in the eye on this. And AIPAC themselves said, don't attach this to the veterans bill.
Right. The veterans bill was the one that undid the sequester cuts to veterans benefits, right?
Yes, it did, and it also takes the money that was spent in two wars to basically, you know, pay for it, and then the Republicans, led by McConnell on this, I don't know if he's using this as some type of primary tool, but have said, you know, they didn't want that to happen. What do they want? The money to go back into Iraq and Afghanistan, where we're not spending it right now anyway.
In other words, there was money appropriated for Iraq and Afghanistan. That money's in the budget right now. We don't need to spend it, so we're going to shift it over to the veterans. McConnell is saying no?
Yes, because the Republicans cited several concerns with the bill, you know, and including the Iran sanctions, which AIPAC doesn't want to include into this bill,
right.
And also including its funding. The money originally was intended for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's included in funding this.
Right.
So I don't understand where they're complaining, because we're not into it.
They just don't want to pass any legislation that's going to make anybody happy who might then thank the president for it.
But what a one to pick. Veterans? Healthcare?
Really. Well, they're doing it with unemployment right now. You know, you've got almost 2 million people who many of whom are now looking at homelessness as a result of almost 3 months of Republican inaction here. It'll be 3 months in a couple of days. Bob Nay,
with the Talk Radio News Service, a former Republican congressman from the House of Representatives from Ohio and author of Sideswipe. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is the Reverend Derek Grayson. Reverend Grayson is a candidate for the United States Senate running against Saxby Chambliss in the Republican primary. Saxby Chambliss is the current Republican United States Senator from Georgia. His website, Mr. Grayson's website, is Grayson2014. .com. Grayson spelled the same way as the progressive Democrat from Florida, although you are a conservative Republican. Do I have that right, Reverend Grayson?
Well, you got it almost right, except I'm not running against Saxby. He's retiring.
Oh, he is? And, oh, he is. Okay, thank you for that.
Yes, and it's Minister Grayson, or just Derek.
Okay.
I despise that term, Reverend.
Okay. All right, but you do have the title, right?
Minister Grayson is my title in clergy, but you can just call me Derek.
Okay, so you're running to be basically a, you said that you identify yourself as a Rand Paul Republican, or a Ron Paul Republican, rather, and the party, the Republican Party in Georgia, apparently is not taking kindly to that, or you're black, and apparently from some of the comments that I've read, the Republican Party in Georgia is not taking kindly to that. Which is it? What's going on down there in Georgia?
Okay. Well, first off, I've never described myself as a Rand Paul or a Ron Paul Republican. Okay. I'm a member of the Republican Party. If you're going to put a label on me, I am a conservative constitutionalist or a constitutionalist conservative. People throw that label on me because I supported Ron Paul.
Yeah, I mean, in this article that I'm reading, it says you describe yourself as a Ron Paul Republican in your videos.
Okay, well, whoever said that didn't get that quote from me because I don't.
Cool.
I believe in the Constitution, as did Ron Paul, and that is why I supported him. What's going on down here in Georgia, and not just Georgia, I spoke to this with the young Republicans the other, I think it was Tuesday night, the Republican Party, the RNC, they put out a mandate because they realized that the Republican Party was not doing enough to reach across racial lines. So their mandate was to be more inclusive. However, apparently many of the organizations that belong to the Republican Party don't seem to be taking that seriously, and they don't. A gentleman, one of my opponents, mentioned that we've run away many of the minorities, and I had to correct him. We haven't ran away minorities. We haven't been a major part of this party since after Reconstruction and the Great Depression, when they were bought under the social democratic policies of FDR, and they moved to the Democratic Party. So It's been a long time.
FDR bought a lot of white people too. I mean, you know, if what you're saying is that by employing people, by having government be the employer of last resort and passing Social Security and the WPA and all that, that was pretty biracial, wasn't it?
Not when it came to black folk. Okay. Black folk almost in wholesale lot shifted from the Republican Party, for which they were mostly a part of because of, if anybody's familiar with history,
right.
It was the Republican
Abraham
Party
Lincoln.
That right. was responsible for the emancipation.
Right.
So blacks ended up leaving the Republican Party for the Democratic Party as a deal that was crafted under FDR to provide them with welfare during the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl era, so to speak. The money that they provided to the farmers, they carved out a portion, I believe it was 10%, for black folk under the condition that the mayors and preachers of those towns in the northern areas would encourage black folk to shift from their Republican leanings to Democratic leanings.
Well, if you're helping the people out, you don't have to have any condition. People will vote for you. I mean, isn't that how it works?
People tend to vote for those that they think will give them something extra. We've moved away from people voting for folk that will ensure their liberties and freedoms. And we have to understand the motivations of folk can be different based on who they are.
Well, aren't liberties and freedoms one of the things that politicians can either work for or against, and voters will react to and vote for or against?
Okay.
Just like Social Security?
Just like Social Security?
And Franklin Roosevelt was positing that Social Security was and his famous phrase was, a necessitous man is not a free man. That if you don't have a job, you're not free. If you don't have a home, you're not free. If you don't have the basic necessities of life, if your kids can't go to school, you're not free. Well, provide those things, and now you've got a platform to stand on to participate in society as a free person.
Well, first off, it's not government's responsibility to provide jobs. It is government's responsibility to ensure that there is an environment that is healthy enough for those who do provide jobs, i.e. the citizens, so that they can go out and provide those jobs.
So you think the Constitution says that the government's not supposed to provide for the general welfare, it's supposed to provide for corporations to provide for the general welfare?
I never said that either. I said that the government is responsible for providing for general welfare, and general welfare is not inclusive of ensuring that everyone has a job. General welfare is to ensure that we have a healthy environment that we may flourish within.
Okay. So we can debate and disagree on that, but I think it's a legitimate your point is legitimate, and I think my disagreement is, but in any case, we can agree to disagree on that issue. But you had said that the Georgia Republican Assembly is full of a bunch of damn bigots, if I'm quoting you correctly. What is the Georgia Republican Assembly, and why did you say that? We have about 2 minutes left, sir.
Okay. The Georgia Republican Assembly is a group that identifies themselves as Republicans. They sent out a straw poll. The excuse that they used for not listing me on the straw poll was that I was not listed in Wikipedia. Well, that is utter nonsense. I've been listed as a bona fide candidate since last March. There is no way that anybody in a position of authority or leadership within any group that is a part of the Republican Party should not have known that I was running. So the only thing I could surmise in my being excluded from that poll was, let's preclude this choice. Let us exclude this choice because we don't want people to know that they're there. And the only reason I can come up with is either they're afraid of my message or they just don't want to be inclusive as the RNC has mandated.
Yeah. When did Wikipedia become the arbiter of who is and isn't eligible to run for public office? I mean, that's a pretty...
Sir, you and I are on the same page.
Yeah, I don't think Wikipedia would be taking that position, much less anybody else in this country.
Listen, I've been on Wikipedia listed as a candidate since May of 2013. So
right.
That argument just didn't hold water for me.
Right.
And again, if you're in a position of authority within any group that claims to be a Republican and you're having meetings about elections, et cetera, et cetera, if you didn't know that I was running, then you don't need to be in that
position. So we're back to my original question. We just have half a minute here. Do you think that they are excluding you because you're black, or do you think that they're excluding you because you're more of a libertarian?
I think they're excluding me because of my message. Now, they may identify me as a libertarian, but I talk about the political royals in both parties. They have bastardized the election process, and they need to be dealt with. They exist in both the Republican and Democratic Party, and I am on a mission to destroy them.
Interesting. Well, you're not going to get any disagreement from me on that. Grayson2014.com is his website. It's Minister Derek Grayson, candidate for the United States Senate, running in Georgia, from Georgia, running for the seat currently held by Senator Saxby Chambliss, who is retiring and running as a Republican. Minister Grayson, good luck.
Thank you very much, sir.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm sorry, say that again. He hung up. Okay, thanks a lot. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave at St. Paul, Nebraska. Hey, Dave, you wanted to talk about honey and raw sugar?
Yeah, Tom. We have been living primarily organically for a number of years, and we've taken to turbinado. You familiar with that term?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically sugar that still has some molasses
it's
in it.
Dehydrated organic cane juice.
Right.
And it looks very much like brown sugar, but it's raw sugar.
Right.
But I wonder how that something like that and honey would fit into the whole scheme of things.
Well, again, if you go, and this is me speculating, okay? I don't have any. I encourage you to find the hard science on your own or to read that article I was sharing with you. But my personal take on it is that we evolved over a period of hundreds of thousands of years in a way that in order to ensure our survival during times of feast and famine, which was a perpetual, reality for hunting gathering people, is a perpetual reality for hunting gathering people. They might go 2 or 3 days between, successful hunts or whatever, foraging. And then you have seasonal variations as well. So we evolved to have bodies that say, if there is something that can be quickly converted into fat in our bodies and thus, stored to give us an extra week of survival time, thus a greater probability of living long enough to pass our genetic material along, if you, take Richard Dawkins' notion that we're gene machines, basically, then we evolved with bodies that were designed to crave salt, you need a certain amount of salt to maintain, because particularly in a hot environment, which is where we evolved in Central Africa, and sugars and fats. And so I would think that raw sugar and honey, these are the things, people chewed on sugar cane, people ate honey back in the day, but that was back in the day when they weren't eating 2,500 calories a day every day, or even 1,500 calories a day every day. They would have one day that's a 300 or 400 calorie day followed by a 2,000 calorie day. And so I would think for somebody who is eating to the point where they're full and satisfied every single day, that those things would be dangerous.
Perhaps. I had a personal problem with high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
I was having acid reflux, and it seemed to coincide with when you went to a fast food place and they had the soda pumps out there, take all you want. And
I've been on a tear about high fructose corn syrup for 10 years on this program. In fact, the high fructose corn syrup trade association sent me a 4-color brochure and a nasty letter. It's incredible.
You're doing something right there.
Yeah, I guess, It's like, why are you picking on us, It's, well.
Yeah, well, once I quit that and went to a sugared soft drink, all my acid reflux went away.
Yeah. Well, wait until you hit your 50s or 60s, unless you're already there.
I'm way there.
Yeah, okay. Well, me too. And I'm noticing now, I've added a couple of inches to my waist just over the last few months. And looking back, it's like I've been eating sugar every night before I go to bed. And it's like, okay, I'm going to stop doing that. So anyhow, Dave, thanks a lot for the call. And, get back to close the fit. 20 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. We will be right back. Hey, it's Thursday. Let's get geeky on our pampered pooches and feline friends. Geeky science, you know, for the... Just give me 3 minutes here. First, if you have a cat, you probably notice how that furry feline can do some pretty crazy things, especially at night. It's amazing. We've got this new kitten, Wolfie, and it turn off the lights at night. Zoom, zoom, zoom. He's still flying around. How does he do that? Sometimes it looks like he's staring at things that aren't there. Sometimes it looks like he can see in the dark. Well, according to your research, he might be seeing things that aren't there, that are there, that you and I can't see. A new study suggests that cats, dogs, and some other mammals have ultraviolet vision, UV vision. And so they can therefore see a spectrum of the light frequencies that human eyes can't see. Light is made up of a whole bunch of different colors. Visible light, which humans can see, spans from red to violet. And beyond that is called ultraviolet light. And scientists have known for a while that a variety of animals, bats, insects, can see ultraviolet light wavelengths. But cats and dogs, we didn't know about. Until now. In other pet-related news, it turns out dogs are a lot more in tune with their owners' feelings and emotions than was previously thought. Researchers in Hungary have found that a dog's brain reacts to voices the same way that a human brain does. And it reacts to emotionally charged sounds or tones in your voice in the same way that humans do. After extensive training, researchers gave 11 dogs MRI scans to see how their brains reacted to various voices and sounds. Did the same thing with a group of 22 human study participants. Played over 200 different sounds to both the dogs and the people, including whistle sounds, car sounds, nature sounds, and human sounds. And what the researchers found was that the same region of the brain located within the temporal lobe of the brain, this is the side of the brain that reacted in both the dogs and the humans' brains when they heard human voices and sounds. Both the dogs and the people also reacted similarly to emotional sounds like crying and laughing. So the next time your cat starts looking frantically across the room at what looks like an empty space, there might actually be something there or some kind of reflection that you can't see. And when it comes to your playful pooches, the next time they come up to you when you're crying, it might not just be a coincidence. They're actually getting your emotions. Sheila in Warrenville, Illinois. Hey, Sheila, thanks for listening to TuneIn Radio. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to chime in on another reason why sugar is bad for everybody. And the fatty liver disease that you were talking about is causing liver transplant potential donors to be rejected because the fat in the liver doesn't filter, so they can't use those for transplantation. So live or deceased donors get turned down because there's just too much fat in their liver.
How do you know that?
Job in some. My husband is a liver transplant recipient. Luckily, our son was his donor, but he shortly after they put him on the transplant list, he got a phone call saying that there was an available liver, but was too fatty, so they didn't accept it. And his doctor tells us that often that they are rejecting more and more livers for donation just because we consume too much sugar that puts too much fat in the liver and those fatty areas don't filter.
Wow. And the thing that I thought was really good news in this article was that if you stop eating sugar, your liver gets unfatty really fast.
Well, the liver is the most amazing organ in your body because it will regenerate from the damage.
Right.
So my son donated 70% of his liver to his father, and within 8 weeks, they both had almost a full-size liver again.
Wow.
And if they could figure that out, then they could harvest any organ you needed. But
right.
Still working on that part.
Yeah, so, no. What are they called? Hepatoblastic cells? Hepatoblasts? Is that the name?
Oh, I don't know.
Is a word for liver cells.
My head.
Yeah, I know that the liver is the most regenerative. It's also one of the most abused. I mean, you know, it's
absolutely.
Which is why it has to be.
The garbage dump of the body, basically.
Yeah.
It filters out all the crud that we subject our bodies to.
Yeah.
And sadly, hepatitis C is the number one reason that people need transplants, and all of the baby boomers that acquired it before the blood supply got safe are mostly at risk now. So you're going to start seeing more commercials for new hepatitis C drugs and things like that.
Oh, yeah. They've got a couple of breakthrough drugs, or at least they claim they are, coming out in the next year or so.
Well, they're actually working. He should be able to get on those this year, and we are cautiously optimistic that he'll be cured of his hepatitis by the end of the year, too. So not only will he have a new liver functioning, because sadly, even though you get a liver transplant, you still have hepatitis C, and now you're immune suppressed, so it still attacks, it starts to attack the liver even more.
Amazing.
So, but all is well, and we are hoping. But yeah, that is a big problem, that all of these baby boomers that are going to need liver transplants, there'll be less and less
fewer and fewer
for that purpose.
Yeah, available, because people getting in car accidents and dying have been eating sugar. Amazing. Sheila, thank you for calling and sharing that with us. That's very, very, that's fascinating. Lucy in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Lucy. What's up?
Hey, I actually wanted to talk about the reasons Democrats went out.
Go for it.
But first, I have to tell you, this conversation about sugar, you just added a missing piece of my health puzzle. So you've done me a great service, and I also just crash after eating sugar at night. I've used it before the same way.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of people do, and it's like I'm going to have to break that addiction, you know.
Well, yeah, I've known it's been mine for a while, but you know, and talking about fatty liver and all that, I mean, I should be talking about that instead of the Democrats. But
yeah, but we're almost out of time, Lucy. So quick comment.
Yeah. Well, just I'll try to be as quick as I can. You know, we've known for a long time that Congress runs on more than just money, you know, from lobbyists. It's also fueled by blackmail and fear and intimidation. And, you know, it's kind of a crazy place there. And, you know, I just feel like we can't pass any laws we need or guarantee the success of Move to Amend and issues other progressive organizations are working on until we eradicate it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we need a wave of candidates who are willing to be single-term politicians in order to combat the blackmail.
I'm with you. And then, you know, Republicans back during the Gingrich Revolution actually claimed that they were that. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THO.
And you'll remember back in the 90s, they all took this oath, I will only serve one term, and people voted them in, and most of them are still there. I mean, that's Lucy, thank you for the call. Helping you in the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, how you doing?
All right. I caught Patrick Moore, who is the science creator of Greenpeace.
No, he's not.
He was not
the science creator of Greenpeace. He was with a group of people. They went out with what was an organization that preceded Greenpeace and started protesting some anti-environment actions. I forget exactly which they were, and became one of the founders of Greenpeace. He then left Greenpeace. Greenpeace now says, and I quote, he exploits long-gone ties with Greenpeace to sell himself as a speaker and pro-corporate spokesperson, and he's on the board of companies in Next Energy, a Canadian energy services company, BC Carbon Project, he founds and chairs. This is a guy who basically has made a living selling out to corporations, particularly carbon-based corporations, using the canard that it's true, but misleading that he was one of the founders of Greenpeace. He was with Greenpeace from 1981 to 1986.
Somehow I knew you'd have pleasant things to say about him.
Patrick Moore is one of these, tragically, you see these folks who I forget the old saying that Will Rogers, I think the impact that a man's paycheck has on his opinions. And I think he's a classic example of it.
Well, it does kind of correspond with the fact that the whole global warming thing has not been proven or has not been codified in any credible scientific evidence.
That's total nonsense, Steve. 100% of the scientists who signed off on the IPCC report, that's a consensus statement, so everybody agreed on it. The 3% of scientists who have published in peer-reviewed journals who argue that global climate change is, whether it's entirely or largely caused by human activity, that 3%, first of all, if you look at the quality of their writings, in other words, the number of times that they have been published or the number of times that they have been cited, it is well below the average of the people who are members of the IPCC. And secondly, 3% of scientists are saying this. 4% of Americans believe, and this is, you know, there have been several studies that have independently verified this, 4% of Americans believe that there are lizard people on Earth who zip on human suits and pretend that they're humans. And, you know, a fairly good percentage of them believe that Bill Clinton was one of those. And there's, you know, David Icke makes a living giving speeches about this. So 4% of Americans believe that there are lizard people among us. 3% of scientists say there's no such thing as global warming. Is that really the camp you want to hang out in, Steve?
Well, in other words, you're talking about people who are fans of Doctor Who. But other than that, the point is that there has not been these models have been proven to be a fraud.
The models have been proven to be conservative. Global warming is happening faster than it was projected back in the 70s and 80s, and it's happening. In fact, every single time the IPCC comes out with a new report, they have to say, oops, in the last report, we presented the most probable case and the worst case, and now that we look back on it, the worst case is what happened, so we should have called that the most probable.
Well, the IPCC report is a political statement.
It is not a political statement. There's not a single politician in that body.
I think everybody.
It is a scientific consensus statement.
No, there is no consensus in science.
There
it doesn't exist.
There absolutely is a consensus in science. If you were to ask the majority of scientists if the Earth is round, the majority of them would say yes. If you were to ask them if gravity is one of the weak forces, the majority of them would say yes. Of course there are consensuses in science. You know, is gonorrhea caused by a bacteria? What do I realize there are some people out there who are going to say, you know, no, I'm a Christian scientist. It's caused because somebody didn't pray the right way or some other religion, maybe not Christian science. But, you know, there is a scientific consensus on the vast majority of things, including the fact that the planet is being warmed by our having thrown 350 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere that wasn't there prior to the advent of the human race 165,000 years ago, over the last 100 years.
We have had 10 times that amount, and we've had glaciers, and then we've had subtropical conditions in the South Pole. So
yes, and we've had continents move. We've had massive
relation. There's no relation at all between carbon and the temperature.
Nonsense. If you look at those times when the carbon levels in the atmosphere have been radically higher than they have been now, for example, when Pangaea split into two continents, or when those two continents split into five continents, and they opened huge fissures in the earth 250 years ago during the Permian, when the Siberian traps poured hundreds of billions of tons of lava out into the onto the ocean and onto the sea, onto the earth, creating basically what is now Siberia, that threw so much carbon into the atmosphere that it warmed the planet so dramatically that it killed 95% of all life on Earth. There's an absolute correlation. Even the people who deny whether human carbon in the atmosphere is enough to cause climate change will acknowledge that there's an association between carbon in the atmosphere and temperature. I don't know anybody who's denying that. Do you? Can you name one scientist who's denying that? Even Fred Singer acknowledges that. And he's the guy who used to be, before he started getting paid to deny climate science, he used to deny that tobacco caused cancer.
Well, another study that came out yesterday is 51% of the Democrats do not know that the Earth rotates around the sun. That was another one. That sort of explains the election results.
Yeah, right. I saw the study you're talking about. It didn't say 51% of Democrats. What it said was something like a third of Americans. In fact, it was less than a third of Americans on the Earth rotates around the sun. 25%. Yeah. Okay. 24, 25% of Americans don't think that the sun revolves around the earth. That's a sad commentary on what's happened to our public education system since the days of Ronald Reagan. We used to produce the best scientists in the world until Reagan put Bill Bennett in charge of the Department of Education, a guy who hated education and who campaigned for president on the Republican ticket on the platform that we should do away with the Department of Education. Our schools have been so screwed over the last 32 years by Reaganomics. It's a true tragedy. Randy in Smock, Pennsylvania. Hey, Randy, you want to talk about Social Security and cost of living adjustments?
Yeah, you spoke earlier. As a matter of fact, I like your rant about the Republican Party and the way they want to cut COLAs. Mm-hmm. Now, I myself wouldn't mind, say, a cut in COLA. Just cut it in half if they want. If, and this is a big if you tax Wall Street transactions. If they can...
Well, if you tax Wall Street transactions, you don't have to cut COLAs.
Why not do both?
Well, the reason why is because the cost of living adjustments for Social Security are tied to a general cost of living, a consumer price index number that applies to everybody in our society. And first of all, it's very conservative. But secondly, it doesn't apply as well to the things that older people overconsume and younger people underconsume. Things like medical services and food and housing. These are, it includes things like computers and toys and transportation and vacations and stuff that by and large older people don't consume. And many of those things have gone down in price. Transportation's gone down in price in real dollars over the last 100 years dramatically. Lots and lots of competition. Older people are not flying that much. You know, but housing has gone up. Food has gone up and medical services have gone up almost exponentially. So the consequence of that is that in 1965, you could retire with Social Security and nothing else and actually live in most parts of the United States. Today, you can't. And so not only do we need to have our cost of living for people on Social Security keep up with the real cost of living, we need to actually upgrade it rather than downgrade it, like with the chain CPI. But we need to make up for the difference between 1968 and today. It's the same thing, by the way, with unemployment insurance, although there's not a COLA associated with that. It's a congressional COLA, I suppose. If you were to fix the minimum wage, if you were to fix the minimum wage at where it was in 68, it would be, it would be over $10. It would be over $12 right now. So, I would say that, yes, we need a tax on Wall Street transactions in part, in fact, in largest part, because it'll slow down what is now accounting for 70% of all the activity on Wall Street, which is these high-speed trades being done by computer that are, making billionaires on Wall Street and causing everybody with a 401k to lose out and making the market highly volatile. And if you put just a tiny tax, a tenth of a cent on every transaction, suddenly that's no longer a viable business model. And two, we need to eliminate the cap on Social Security so that people who make more than $114,000 a year pay the same percentage of their income into the Social Security Trust Fund as people who make under $114,000 a year. And then it's solvent forever. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Thank you, Randy.
About three weeks ago, C-SPAN had on the founder of Moody's Rating Agency, and he said, quote, that a tax could not be applied to transactions made in stocks because you'd have to tax the world. I figured to myself, the SEC doesn't watch fraud. They only take care of what they still goes on here.
Yeah. No, we have a really serious problem in the United States. We started out with a plutonomy. An oligarchic or plutocratic economy. And now that economy, the people in that economy are now taking over government. Now we have a plutocracy, an oligarchy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we have to break up both the oligarchy, the government ruled by rich people, and the oligonomy, the economy ruled by rich people. That's a huge job. Welcome back. Conrad in Ramona, California, listening or watching on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Ramon, what's up? Or excuse me, Conrad in Ramona, California. Conrad, what's up?
I have a cure for growing police brutality.
Okay, what's that?
The three precursor problems are police elitism. If
you've got a small body of people, it's going to naturally lead to them thinking they're slightly elite. Also, civil servant immunity. And unfortunately, in this country, there's a segment of a population who are, they fetishize the military. Mm-hmm. So the cure, it would be a draft, but not for the military. Everyone serves like a year and a half as a police officer. And what this does, it demystifies the experience. You've seen Americans, especially after 9/11, get misty-eyed about the firemen who died rescuing. There's a double-edged side to that. That's, well, thank God it wasn't me, you know. Mm-hmm. And so this would create a sense of it would if you weren't going to be in the police, you knew you were going to be in the police soon, and you would talk to your uncle who had been. And one thing I noticed, I'm 53, and when I was a kid, I would talk to my dad who'd been in the war and said, wasn't it marvelous? And I've noticed that those World War II vets who were mostly drafted spoke with open disdain for uniforms, rank, and anything to do with the military. They couldn't wait to get out, but they had the training as well.
Yeah, and same with Vietnam vets.
Yeah. So the result is you've been a police officer. A police officer stops you for something, and two things happen. You're bound to be a little bit more polite because you've been there, but also you're armed, and you're in the sense that, no, you can't do that.
Because I used to have your job. I know what it's, yeah. That's very interesting. Yeah. I've never even considered a draft, you know, that police, I mean, this is the kind of thing where it would be like, you could do it like jury duty, too. I mean, this is the old polis. Go back to the Greek polis. The idea that, you know, in ancient Athens, it took 6,000 people to make a decision, a political decision. And so everybody, it was a lottery. It was like jury duty. And when you got called up, if you didn't show up, you were referred to as an idiota, which is where that word came from, idiot in our language. And to have our police departments, that's a very, let me chew on that for a little bit. I think, you know, another possible remedy would be simply to have all police officers wear a camera. We now have the technology, basically Google Glass, you know, wear a camera on their lapel that continuously records everything they're saying and doing. That is only turned off when they're not on duty or when they're using the bathroom. Well, presumably you're not on duty when you're using the bathroom. So, you know, they have private space. But whenever they're actually interacting with the public, that camera is on. And not only is it on, but it is absolutely subject to Freedom of Information Act requests. Anybody can ask to see it anytime. And I think if we did that really, really simple act of, you know, basically we're watching you behave yourself, you would see a radical change in police behavior across the United States. And then on top of that, I think that we should say, okay, now that you've got this job and you got to be very professional and we're going to hold you at a high standard, we're going to pay you better. I think that we should pay our cops better. Conrad, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back, 10 minutes before the hour. Ten minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, Mr. Kim, listening on WBAI, New Rochelle, New York. Hey, sir, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. You got me a little quicker, and I'm now back at the phone.
Thank you. You wanted to talk about the Social Security cost of living adjustments.
You're right. Cost of living is really not adequate. I think this is where Greenspan and some of the Republicans wanted to cut that. I don't know what kind of arguments they were using. I'm sure they were bogus. But there's also something else going on. It's not just the cost of living from inflation. There's something called economic growth. And that's, I think, 1.1%. And this takes into account increase in population. So it's a net 1.1%. We get richer every year on the average by about that amount.
So to keep up with that, if you're on a fixed income, to keep up with that, your fixed income has to grow by that amount.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
So in other words, and that's an enormous difference between 3% and 4%. Obviously, it's another 33% over time.
Right.
So I'm in poverty, unfortunately, as a retiree on Social Security. I get SSI and I get Section 8. I'm still in poverty.
Right. I would submit to you that you have identified the reason why, even though Social Security has a cost of living adjustment attached to it, the reason why you could have retired and not lived in poverty in 1965 on Social Security and you can't today?
I think that's probably right. And so I'm falling behind 1% a year because everybody else is getting richer at that 1%,
right,
but not me.
And that's been going on since 1935. I think you nailed it. I'm going to have to dig into that a little further. But, you know, it's like our money supply expands, our economy expands. We don't always call all of that inflation. But for purposes of Social Security, we should be looking at that. Thank you, Mr. Kim. I appreciate the call. Stephen, in Makawaho, Hawaii.
Makawa. Mahalo, Mr. Hartman, for taking my call. I have one quick comment on the sugar. And what sugar does is drive inflammation, which ends up being the real cause of infections and
cancer. I mean, we know that the way that the papillomavirus causes genital cancer and throat cancer is cervical cancer and throat cancer is by producing inflammation.
Exactly. But the real reason I was calling, and I'm just finally stopped spinning from the last Steve, from whatever he was saying about the earth spinning around anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little off base there, but I'm an organic farmer, and if you can increase, if we have small farms, and we can increase our organic matter per acre 1%, it will sequester 37,000 pounds of carbon dioxide. And I know that's,
yes,
you know, like just a little less than 4 tons, but it's...
you're right. If we were to convert the world to organic agriculture tomorrow, it would sequester an enormous amount of carbon. The problem is that we continue to emit an enormous amount of carbon.
Exactly. And unfortunately, just the confinement feedlots in the United States, mostly up in Northern California and beyond, emit more emissions than all the autos that we have in the United States.
Yeah.
And what's worse than that is the methane. They're emitting methane,
right,
which is a lot.
Which is a very, very potent greenhouse gas. No, I'm with you, Stephen.
The methane that's being released because of the freezing or the thawing of the Arctic,
yes,
will probably be our undoing.
Yep. arctic-news.blogspot.com for more information on that. Stephen, thank you for the call. Kirk, listening on 91.3 FM KBCS, our Pacific affiliate in Bothell, Washington. Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Tom, it's Ralph Nader's birthday today, and I think we all owe quite a debt to Tom for his consumer and political activism.
Yeah, you know, day before yesterday, I talked about this on the radio. Day before yesterday, I was over at the RT studios where I usually am in the morning. We're doing show prep both for the TV show and for the radio show, and Ralph Nader was there. He was being interviewed by Larry King, who has a program on RT, and Larry was having a... They were, you know, doing all the technical stuff, and so Ralph had like 20 minutes, and I ran into him in the makeup room, actually. And we just started talking, and I remembered that it's his 80th birthday this week, because I had looked up, like, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, somebody asked me how old he was, and I just Googled it. And I was like, whoa, this is his birthday. And so I said, happy birthday. He was like, well, you're a few days early. He's so precise, you know? And I said, yeah, I know, but I'm probably not going to see you on Thursday or Friday, so I wanted to wish you a happy birthday. And he seemed pleased by that. He's got a new book coming out in April. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Kirk. Ralph's new book, by the way, well, I don't want to give it away. He's going to be on our program to talk about it. Dave in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Dave, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Got a question. Your sugar, fructose,
right,
and glucose for table sugar.
Right.
They did a study a year or so ago from USC. They had a program on DISH this about a year ago. A doctor found the metabolic breakdown in the liver. Produces 30% of the fructose, which is the only place it can be metabolized in the liver, is
right,
turned into the
worse kind of cholesterol for your veins and arteries.
Right. It you're absolutely right. And that's in that article in the New York Times. It increases the LDL or HDL, whichever the type of cholesterol it is, that it, you know, that eating fructose and high fructose corn syrup is associated with increases in triglycerides in these fats, particularly those that are associated with cholesterol. Good point, Dave. Thank you for calling and making it. And it's interesting to hear that there's more research recently on that, because the article that I was reading was a couple of years old. Coming up tomorrow's Friday. So, of course, it means Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be here talking about all the important issues of the day and taking your calls for an hour. Plus, anything goes Friday. What would you like to talk about? Are there lizard people on Earth? And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Seriously. Move to amend.org, free-don.com. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.